This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At last word, all of the major networks and cable channels plan to carry complete live coverage of tomorrow's memorial service for Michael Jackson in Los Angeles. From time to time, NPR news analyst Ted Koppel joins us to talk about the major issues of the day. And today he focuses on the wall-to-wall coverage of the death of Michael Jackson. Ted?
Thank you, Neil. Big story? You bet. Unprecedented? Nah. Just think of Princess Di, Elvis, O.J. There's a reason it's called the news business, and sometimes the tackier a story, the more business it generates. The late, great Baltimore newspaper man H.L. Mencken once summarized it this way. No one, he said, ever went broke underestimating the good taste of the American public. Mencken might have been referring to what happened when his contemporary, the silent film star Rudolph Valentino, died. 100,000 people lined the streets of New York. There was an all-day riot outside the Frank Campbell funeral home. People trying to get in smashed the windows. Several despondent fans were said to have committed suicide. There was a funeral in New York. Then the body was shipped by train to Beverly Hills, California, for a second funeral. That was in August of 1926. Pre-Twitter, pre-cable, pre-television. But it was great copy, and radio and the newspapers went to town on it. Readers, listeners, viewers, when the numbers go up, so does income. That was true 80 years ago. It's true now. So when a 6-year-old documentary shows a certain superstar acknowledging a taste for sharing his bed with young boys, do not be surprised to learn that MSNBC has aired the program 6 times already. Indeed, writes the television columnist for The Washington Post, MSNBC intends to show the documentary 6 more times this month. It's true. There's no business like show business.
And Ted, to be fair, 30 years ago, ABC News decided to respond to the enormous public interest in the U.S. hostages in Iran and started a program that would later become known as Nightline.
Is that a fact?
Indeed.
It is. I would make only one argument that I would say differentiates what happened then with this particular incident, and that is that was of ongoing importance. Indeed, 30 years later, we're still dealing with the consequences of what the Iranians did and the taking of those American hostages. And I think that was a news story that not only had legs, it had substance.
So how much should a news organization respond to public interest, to relevance, some might say, and how much to issues arguably more important but almost guaranteed to draw smaller audiences? In other words, should the news give you what you want or what you need? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Ted, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No. I didn't realize you were doing a little phone promo there. The only point I was going to make, Neil, is I think it has to be both. Claire Booth Luce, I'm reliably informed, once coined an absolutely great definition of journalism, and that is, she said, journalism should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I think if a major story does one or the other of those, then we're on the right track. The question you raised before, or rather the answer to the question that you raised before, I think, is it has to be both. If there is a raging public interest in a story, as clearly there is in the aftermath of Michael Jackson's death, yes, of course the media have to cover it. Do the media have to cover it quite as extensively as it is being covered now? Not a bit of it. The fact of the matter is what is happening right now has one reason and one reason only, and that is profit. Every one of these cable networks and commercial networks that are covering the story and indeed sending their top anchors to Los Angeles to be there for the memorial service tomorrow are doing it only for that reason. They know they're going to get a huge audience and they can make money doing it.
Well, the ratings numbers for CNN in particular have been going through the roof since the death of Michael Jackson. I think they were up
400%, I think they were up. and those two.
At a time, well, as you pointed out, the Rudolph Valentino funeral, the Lindbergh kidnapping, any number of stories when the media was in its heyday. Nevertheless, this is a time when a lot of news media are suffering, the traditional mainstream news media. And if you're not going to jump on the public interest, you're going to be left behind.
And I have no trouble with that. The only thing I do have trouble with is when the bad forces out the good. What has been happening over the past 10, 15 years, Neil, with the exception, of course, of a truly major U.S. military engagement, as was and has been the case in Iraq, is that by and large foreign stories are not being covered properly anymore. When I say properly, when I was a young foreign correspondent about 30 years ago, I would say I had about 30, if not 35, colleagues who were foreign correspondents at ABC alone. To the best of my knowledge, ABC, I think, only has 5 foreign correspondents these days. And the other networks, it's essentially the same thing, with the exception of CNN, which, of course, does have worldwide coverage. To the degree that stories like the Michael Jackson story or the Princess Di story or the O.J. Simpson story or the death of Elvis story, to the degree that those use up all the funds so that there isn't then enough money there to cover the truly important stories anymore, then I think it becomes something that ought to be of public concern.
Wait. You can't have it both ways. Use up all of the funds. These are generating the profits that would then enable you to send a correspondent to Baghdad.
One would think. You're absolutely right. If indeed they were going to use that money then so that they could reopen their bureau in Moscow or reopen all the bureaus they've been closing down over the past 20 years, I would wince a little, but I'd say, you know something, it's in a good cause. I don't think that's what's happening, Neil.
Let's see if we get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Daniel. Daniel with us from Fort Myers in Florida.
Hi. Yeah, I worked at a newspaper years back, and we were trying to deal with a loss of readership. And I remember the conversation was about kind of making the language more accessible and making the storylines more entertaining. And, you know, it didn't work. And I always felt, and I was raised to feel, that media has an obligation to invest in their readers, to make kind of a long-term relationship. And I think media fails to do that now. I think often what they choose to cover is so light and so lame that in the long run, they're going to end up hurting themselves.
And become irrelevant to their readers, leaving them in droves?
That's what I believe. I remember years back reading an article that David Brooks wrote in the New York Times about cleaning out a closet of his grandmother's and looking through the old news, you know, the old magazines, Life and so forth, and how highbrow what they wrote was in the 30s and 40s. I mean, they were talking about art, they were talking about psychology, and if you pick up a magazine or a newspaper today, you know, it doesn't inspire people to learn, and certainly the news doesn't. I would say the one exception to that is NPR, which really does at least inspires me to learn. But I think a lot of the other media fails to think of a long-term relationship with the people that are consuming their content.
Well, we thank you for the kind words, Daniel. Just by way of asking, is that newspaper you used to work for, are they still in business?
They are, but of course their readership is probably, I'm going to guess it's down by 50% from when I used to. Work for them. And this was, I remember the conversation was at a convention, a newspaper convention, where, you know, everybody was talking about how it had to be more accessible. And that really makes me sad. I mean, it used to be that newspaper that I worked for in a small town. The circulation was 20,000. They sent 2 correspondents to Vietnam to cover the Vietnam War. Now, that's because we had our boys, like, you know, fighting in that war. Now, how many people would do that today? Did that make money? Did it cost a lot of money? Of course. But the people that ran the paper at that time felt that they had the obligation. And I think that in the long run, that pays off.
And Ted Koppel, it's interesting that Daniel raises that point at a time when you see once great newspapers like the Boston Globe having no foreign correspondents whatsoever, nobody covering the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq.
That's exactly right. And I would add one element to what Daniel was saying, and that is it's not only that the subject material was, I think he used the word, a little more sophisticated. My old friend and colleague Marvin Kalb, who spent many years working at CBS and then NBC before he went up to Harvard, when he was up at Harvard as a professor, some of his graduate students did a study in which they compared the length of some of the pieces that were done in political coverage on a presidential campaign. I believe it was the campaign of 1968, and they compared it then to, it may have been the campaign of 2000. And I remember his telling me, because back in 1968 I was covering the Nixon campaign, that they used a report I had done for the ABC Evening News on the Nixon campaign that ran slightly in excess of 4 minutes. Well, 4 minutes these days is just incredibly long. And not only are the pieces much, much shorter now, but the sound bites on those pieces, on average, tend to run about 7 or 8 seconds. In the old days, we actually had sound bites in which people were allowed to talk for 15, 20, sometimes even 30 seconds. You simply cannot convey the same amount of information in a piece that is roughly a third the length, or where the sound bites are, you know, half as long or a quarter as long as they were 25, 30, 40 years ago.
Daniel, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And he had some kind words to say about National Public Radio. And just before we leave the subject and go to a short break, we should confirm that tomorrow, during the Michael Jackson Memorial, we're going to be planning some coverage on this program at this time tomorrow. This is not quite the same. We may or may not get greater ratings. The motivations are not different, but this is an important story that a lot of people feel very strongly about, and it will be the talk of the nation tomorrow. So join us for that. Ted Koppel is going to come back as we continue this conversation. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Everybody's talking about the death of pop icon Michael Jackson. No doubt the amount of news coverage it's generating is due to that buzz. But with a country mired in unemployment, a debate over health care, two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that coverage proportional or even reasonable? Right now, NPR news analyst Ted Koppel is with us. We're talking about the show business of the new business. You can read his commentary on how much the former has to do with the latter at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We want to hear from you. How much should the news business give you what you want, the stories you're already interested in, versus bringing you important stories you don't know about, new to your radar? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Let's go next to Celia. Celia with us from Moab in Utah.
Yeah, thanks so much for the conversation and also for bringing Ted on the show. You know, I have to say the question is about what we really want. And what I really want to say is I speak for a lot of us who consume news and try to make news on important issues. And what do we do as consumers to get the more in-depth stories, the investigative coverage, the coverage on issues like healthcare and education and climate change that we really do want? Because I think there's a misnomer that all of us want more Michael, more Britney Spears, but there's a lot of us out there who really want these important stories of the times to get told. So, Ted, what can we do to support journalists in getting those stories told?
Oh, I think you're doing it. There are so many millions of people, and I'm just distant enough from NPR. I only show up here a couple of times a month that I think I can do a little bragging in NPR's behalf. You look at Morning Edition, you look at Talk of the Nation, you look at All Things Considered. These are programs that quite literally pull in millions of listeners every day. And while I suspect my friend Neil Conan was probably a little awkward in the context of this conversation, having to say that, yes, you're going to cover it again tomorrow, there is no story that you cannot cover. It's a question of how you cover it. It's a question of what you do. What troubles me is I think the United States has gone through an age of entitlement, this sense that we're, and we see it in our economy, but we also see it in our journalism. There is a sense that we are entitled to hear everything we want to hear. And that manifests itself in conservatives who tune in Fox and who feel they are entitled to hear their own conservative point of view reflected, and liberals who tune in MSNBC and feel they're entitled to have the liberal point of view reflected. You have to do what you're doing already. When you listen to NPR and you express yourself as wanting to hear smart, intelligent, sometimes even protracted conversations on difficult issues, then you're doing what you have to do.
Well, I definitely appreciate that, and I'll confess one other thing, which is that I do public relations work for a lot of nonprofit groups and charities, and we face tremendous challenges along the lines of what you've been discussing on the show today in this age of the shrinking soundbite in telling the important stories and also nationalizing stories that we know are so important regionally to connect the dots on things like climate change and extreme weather events or healthcare crisis, the crisis in education. And it is one of those things where we want to be in partnership with news institutions like NPR that are telling the stories in the way that I really believe the majority of Americans want to hear them. And it's an incredible time. It's a big challenge.
Celia, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Gretchen in Fremont, California. In 1926, my dad was a 12-year-old newspaper boy. He told me he remembered the huge black headline that read, "Valentino Dead." He sold every copy of his newspapers that day. It reminds me of the death of another actor, John Garfield, in the late 40s under scandalous circumstances. And the third day headline is one of my favorite newspaper headlines of all time. Still trying to keep the story alive. John Garfield still dead.
Yes, that actually, believe it or not, was also a Saturday Night Live bit when John Scali of ABC News mistakenly reported that the Spanish dictator Francisco Franco had died. And when it turned out that he was still alive, Saturday Night Live came on the following week with Chevy Chase as the anchorman saying, "Francisco Franco is still critically dead."
We're talking with Ted Koppel. And I wanted to ask you also another story that goes along with the news media and its efforts to find new sources of funds. And that was the revelation that the Washington Post planned to host, the publisher of the Washington Post planned to host salons where reporters would gather with newsmakers and policymakers and members of Congress and government and would be in the presence of sponsors. It would all be off the record, and people would pay $25,000 each to be there.
Yeah, that was a major ouch for the Washington Post, and everyone from people in the newsroom to the editorial staff to the publisher herself were frantically backpedaling to get away from that. And somehow there is some anonymous soul now who put out that pamphlet or leaflet announcing that, who is probably, if he or she is not already looking for a new job, will be very soon, because all fingers are pointing in that direction. Gee whiz, everyone is saying, we didn't know that. We didn't realize that that's the way it sounded. But they've backed away from it totally.
Yet the desire to find new sources of revenue as audiences diminish, and certainly organizations like the Washington Post still trying to be a great newspaper and still sending reporters around the world.
And it is still a great newspaper.
And it is still a great newspaper. Yeah. There's no question about that. The New York Times as well, though people who read the Boston Globe, of course, the New York Times owns the Boston Globe, and they wonder about its priorities. Nevertheless, as you look at these diminishing resources for great organizations, How do they go about this? So many seem to go, as they say, down market, try to reach that lowest common denominator.
Well, let me give our listeners a little bit of an insight. I know more about the television business than I do any other aspect of the media. In television, what's happened, of course, is that you've had a fragmentation. Whereas 40-some-odd years ago when I joined ABC, there were only the three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. And then in the late 70s, 79, along came cable and CNN, and now you have cable and satellites, and you have the Internet. There is such a fragmentation that there is now an effort to find a distinct part of the audience. And that part of the audience which pays the most, by which I mean that part of the audience for which an advertiser or for whom an advertiser will pay the most money, that group is the 18 to 35-year-old group. So what you have is all the networks frantically pushing their programming in a direction that they believe will appeal to that younger demographic. And indeed, in some instances, you find Madison Avenue willing to pay, or at least the advertisers on Madison Avenue willing to pay, four and sometimes five times as much as they would for an audience of people over the age of 50. So what do you get on television for the most part? Programming that is geared toward the younger audience.
Here's an email from Celine in St. Louis. I think there's very little real news gathering and presentation anymore. It's all infotainment presented in short sound bites, acceptable to our short attention spans. NBC Nightly News has a new slogan that goes something like, "Our job is to help you make sense of it all." I disagree. To me, the slogan means they are presenting and interpreting it for us. I don't think that's their job. Their job is to present the news to us and let us draw our own conclusions. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Michael. Michael with us from Birmingham, Alabama.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Interesting discussion. Every few years, it seems, we hear these stories about bemoaning the death of journalism, and this seems to be embodied in the previous caller who talked about local news not covering international news. He was talking about his newspaper that he used to work for, not sending people overseas like they did to Vietnam. You know, I can't help wondering how much of a difference that coverage in Vietnam made compared to the work of David Halberstam and others on the national level who have the qualifications and the stick-to-itiveness to cover those stories. I have this crazy idea that we should have our local journalists covering local stories, and when we are satisfied that local news has been covered adequately, then perhaps we can talk about sending them overseas. But until that point, let's keep our local journalists local.
Well, you have to remember that David Halberstam, and I was over in Vietnam for part of the time at the same time that David was. He was actually representing a local newspaper. Now, it was the New York Times. If what you're saying is that, communities of 100,000 don't need to be sending foreign correspondents overseas, boy, I totally agree with you. I think you're absolutely right. They need to be covering, and maybe that is the way they can start to make money today. If a community comes to realize that their local newspaper is really covering the local news and that they can get the national news then from a few papers like the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the New York Times or from NPR radio, then I think we are beginning to see the sort of distribution of news coverage the way it ought to be. But David, worked for a local paper.
In the sense that local paper was the New York Times, you're right. However, and as a graduate of the University of Missouri School of Journalism, I'm all for flooding the zone with as many journalists as possible. However, I think you do make a good point that as you get down into the smaller newspapers, whether it's 100,000 people in your coverage area or even 500,000 people in your coverage area, I think the question has to be asked, at what point are we not using the few resources that are available to journalists wisely and leaving, not necessarily leaving the job of the New York Times? I think they could stand to have as much competition as any other newspaper nowadays. But, like I said, if we're going to have local journalists, when you tell me that every aspect of your local market has been covered adequately, then it's time to start sending, say, someone from our Birmingham newspaper to Iraq or Afghanistan. But until then,
and until the Alabama National Guard goes there, in which case I think it would be the responsibility of the local paper to send them there, as indeed you've had that situation in several areas when local National Guards, state National Guards went, the state papers always thought it was very important to send their reporters along to cover their boys. Another point to be made, Michael, is that, great national reporters have to start somewhere, even in Birmingham.
They do, and we've had our share. One of them went to Market Watch. However, I don't agree with your point. The Alabama National Guard does go to Iraq. They go to Afghanistan. But what you see on the ground at the local level is that when you send a local reporter to do an international story, you don't really pierce the surface. You get a lot of stories where the troops are wishing their relatives happy holidays and a lot of life as it's lived. You don't have a lot of groundbreaking journalism when you cover, when you send someone from the local papers to do international stories. I'm not saying the local color isn't important and doesn't have a place, but it's not the death of journalism if they're not there.
All right, Michael, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. We're talking today with NPR news analyst Ted Koppel about journalism and the news business. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Ted Koppel, I did want to ask you about one of the stories that is getting less attention today, possibly because of the upcoming arrangements for the memorial service for Michael Jackson than it might have otherwise. The president of the United States, Barack Obama, is in Moscow negotiating strategic arms limitation treaties with the Russian leaderships, the successors to the Soviet Union. Here's what he said today after a meeting with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev.
The President and I agreed that the relationship between Russia and the United States has suffered from a sense of drift. We resolved to reset U.S.-Russian relations so that we can cooperate more effectively in areas of common interest.
A sense of drift seems to be the quote that's leaping out to people. Interesting, Ted, that this comes out on the same day we learn of the death of Robert McNamara, and his death will be, his obituaries will be linked forever to the Vietnam War, which is only appropriate. Nevertheless, Robert McNamara, as Secretary of Defense to President Kennedy and then later President Johnson, played a critical role in the arms race back in the 1960s.
Absolutely, and I think live to regret it and even express regret, certainly insofar as the Vietnam War was concerned. And you and I were chatting by phone a little earlier today and took note of the fact that in 1961, when Jack Kennedy became president and took over from Dwight Eisenhower, Eisenhower, in his farewell speech, warned against, and it became one of the most famous lines from one of the most famous speeches of the 20th century. He warned against the dangers of the industrial-military complex, that you would have a situation in which so much money was being spent on so many weapon systems, and that those weapon systems were being broken up into components that would be built in every congressional district in the country so that no one would have any incentive to stop building those systems. That's essentially where we have been, and it's been growing and growing, and the likelihood that we can actually get a reduction in nuclear weapons at the same time that so many other countries are trying to acquire nuclear weapons. That's going to be one of the great tricks of the 21st century and one of the more difficult stories to cover.
Last time he was on this program, former Secretary of Defense McNamara did express some regret, as you'll recall, Ted, better than I perhaps. In the election of 1960, there was this great concern over the missile gap with the Soviet Union. After taking office, U-2 flights began to take pictures, comprehensive pictures of the Soviet territory, and the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States realized there was no missile gap. The United States was, in fact, ahead on nuclear ballistic missile technology. But nevertheless, Secretary McNamara and the President Kennedy went ahead and ordered the construction of a whole new class of intercontinental ballistic missiles, which played no small part in developing the arms race. Indeed, the coming of to life of that military-industrial complex you were just talking about.
Yeah, I must say, many years ago, I used to be a diplomatic correspondent at ABC News, and in those days, one of the big stories we were covering were the so-called SALT talks, the Strategic Arms Limitation talks. Terribly complicated story, and very, very difficult to do on television in an interesting fashion. But that, Neil, to sort of square the circle here between this story and the one we were talking about before, that's really the responsibility of good journalism, wherever it may be, to take the stories that are of such overwhelming importance to the safety and the welfare of the American people and to make them interesting enough that even though people at first glance may say, what do I care about that? It's our business to explain to them why they should care about it and how it is that these stories are going to affect their lives.
And Ted, you had some kind words to say about NPR listeners. One of their traits is they are quick with corrections. You misspoke. The quote from H.L. Mencken is, nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public rather than the good taste. But, of course, they had the good taste to listen to Ted Koppel today here on Talk of the Nation. Thanks very much for being with us, Ted.
Thank you, Neil.
NPR news analyst Ted Koppel joining us from his home in the Washington, D.C. area. Coming up, J.D. Salinger is famously reclusive. That doesn't mean we can't talk about him on our opinion page this week. Ron Rosenbaum joins us next, urging us to save the Salinger archives. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.